It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Pittsburgh Promise provides scholarship money to Pittsburgh public school students that helps them pay for college. But African-American males make up just 13% of Promise students, despite comprising 27% of the student population. So why are black males getting left out? I'm joined now in studio by Salim Gubriel. He's executive director of the Pittsburgh Promise. Salim Gubriel, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Paul. Great to see you again.
Likewise. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essphgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essphgh. Do you feel that there are ways to make the Pittsburgh Promise more equitable, more flexible, and ultimately more fair to students than it is now? 412-246-2002 is the number to call with a comment or question. And Salim Gubriel, I think that at the outset we should say, if nothing else, this is, nothing is perfect. This is a program that has helped many, many students. That having been said, it has come under criticism, as you are well aware, from some circles. So let's look at what's going on here, and if there are ways that it can be improved, see if they can be considered. Before we go anywhere, let's start with the requirements needed to be considered for the Pittsburgh Promise. We've talked about them before on the show, but there may be people out there listening who are not sure exactly how it works. So let's begin there.
Sure. So in order to get a scholarship from the Pittsburgh Promise, there are two things that are not negotiable. And one of them is living in the city. And the second one is attending and graduating from Pittsburgh Public Schools. So this is solely for city residents who are enrolled and graduate from Pittsburgh Public. But then in addition to these two things, we ask every child in Pittsburgh Public Schools to get a minimum GPA of 2.0 C average, to get a GPA of 2.0 and graduate with 90% school attendance. So show up to school 90% of the time, maintain a C average, and that will guarantee you a substantial scholarship to pursue anything you want to pursue after high school, any form of post-secondary education. So those are the requirements of the Pittsburgh Promise.
And those do not seem to be tremendously difficult to meet. I mean, certainly every student would have a fair opportunity of meeting those standards. How do you decide between applicants who meet all the minimum requirements? Is everybody who meets those minimum requirements guaranteed?
Absolutely. We do not decide between applicants. So if a kid is eligible, a kid gets a scholarship. There are some scholarships that, they have 500 scholarships, 1,000 apply, half of them get it. In our case, every kid who's eligible gets it. Now, I should say here that 75% of the graduates of Pittsburgh Public Schools over the last 8 years have been eligible, but 50% have used their scholarship. So there are some kids who are just simply voluntarily opting out. Now, some are choosing to go to school out of state, and we only support higher education in Pennsylvania. Some are enlisting in the military, and we salute them and say thank you. Get in touch with us when you're discharged and let us know if the GI Bill doesn't cover what you need. But then some are just not enrolling in post-secondary education of any kind. So there is another 25% of our graduates who have money, but they're walking away from it.
To date, 245 African-American males have received a Promise Extension scholarship. Is that enough to say that this scholarship is equitable?
I think you have your data wrong, Paul.
Okay.
246 received the extension, 697 received the full Promise. So really, nearly 1,000 African-American males have received a Promise scholarship. The extension is the lifeline that we throw to kids who fall below our GPA requirements. And we say to them, we're going to give you a second chance if you're interested. And then we will send you to community college with this second chance for 1 year. And you maintain a C average in that year at the community college. Then in the second year, you can take your money and go anywhere you want to. But in total, just under 1,000 African-American males have received a Promise scholarship out of 5,600 recipients.
So that's with the extension that allows them to become eligible, to take more time to become eligible.
Correct. It's buying them an extra year to get their eligibility together.
Are there any statistics that people have brought up? Another statistic that's come up, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Pittsburgh City Paper reported that 445 African-American males who graduated from the district since the Promise's inception, out of them, only 127, or 28.5%, have received the Promise. Assuming that number is correct,
I just told you that nearly 1,000 African-American males have received in total $9.2 million in scholarships from the Pittsburgh Promise. There was not adequate fact-checking in that article by the city paper, which was very disappointing to me. It's a respectable, it's an important paper. It's the free paper that's accessible to everybody. And even the story about the young man who's a fabulous young man who is actually eligible for Promise Scholarship was not vetted to be checked for facts by us at the Promise.
So you're saying that, those statistics that were reported in that story are all incorrect?
I'm not saying they are all incorrect. I'm saying the ones that you just now mentioned.
Those are the ones that would raise a red flag.
Well, precisely. And they were given full, you know, the same sheet with the data that I have in front of me is what I gave them as a part of their preparation. It felt to me like there was the article began with a conclusion, and then the paper was written as opposed to let the facts narrate the story.
Let's talk about the student who was featured that you mentioned. There was a young man who was recently who was profiled as part of that story, a student whose father died, as was reported in the story, whose father died when he was in the 10th grade, when the student was in the 10th grade. And the personal problems he was having as an underclassman adversely affected his GPA to the point where even though he had a 3.7 this past semester, the most recent semester, he had a GPA of 3.7, which is what, an A minus it would be.
I am pausing because first of all, I cannot comment that those
okay.
are FERPA protected. Facts, and I am not sure where the reporter got this. My guess is that the reporter got them from the young man, but I cannot comment on his. I can tell you that he is eligible for a Promise Extension scholarship. And I can also tell you that we have a fairly comprehensive, in fact, very inclusive compassion appeal process. We work very closely with the Department of Human Services. Every single kid who is a ward of, not a ward, who receives services from the Department of Human Services and who for family-related issues have not been able to meet our eligibility criteria. With DHS caseworkers, we have looked closely at every one of those cases. And in a huge percentage of the cases, we have made exceptions.
Well, they reported that he could not get the scholarship because his GPA was too low as a ninth grader. So when it was all averaged together, he could not get the scholarship. He was accepted to Robert Morris, but he could not use Pittsburgh Promise money toward paying that tuition.
So he is eligible for the Promise Extension. Okay.
How does that work, though?
So if your GPA is between 2.0 and 2.49, that's mm-hmm. the extension program. That's the lifeline that we throw young people.
And explain how that works.
Sure. So from the very beginning, the Promise was built around a school reform agenda. So the Promise, which is an independent, privately funded, no tax dollars, locally supported community organization, exists to support the school reform efforts of Pittsburgh Public Schools because we are absolutely convicted of this truth. And that is, if we don't get urban public education right, not only will kids suffer the consequences, all of us will suffer the consequences. So we owe it to our kids to get urban public education right. And then our economy benefits from that. Our quality of life benefits. Our value, our real estate value, everything benefits from that. So so we use the Promise to kind of leverage and lean on the district and the school board and the administration and the teachers union to deliver a higher quality education. So in order to leverage that, the Promise is meant to be a carrot. So kid, if you get a 2.5,
sure,
if you get a 2.5 GPA, you can go anywhere you want to. If you get below a 2.5 GPA, we'll give you a second chance. But for 1 year, you have to kind of get your sea legs at CCAC. And the reason we've done that is because with CCAC, we have funded an office to provide support services for our kids there to help them kind of get themselves up to par. Because, Paul, you know this. You know this better than anybody. Just sending a kid to college, if they're not ready, it's setting them up for failure.
Well, I understand that. But, okay, here's a young man who's been accepted to Robert Morris. And it's you can debate whether he's ready or he's not ready. But the numbers seem to indicate that if in fact he had a 3.7 GPA in the past semester, it would seem to indicate that he is ready. And so what he's being asked to do then, correct me if I'm wrong, he's being asked to forego the first year at RMU to go to community college to then become eligible for the money.
So what I'm telling you is I cannot comment on his GPA because
That's fine.
No, but Paul.
What I'm saying is he's been accepted to RMU. So what he would have to do, and he's not eligible for the money. We know that's a fact, right?
He's eligible for Promise Extension today and then for RMU next year.
Okay, so he would have to put off. He can go this fall to RMU.
Yeah.
He's accepted. He's planning to go. So what you're saying is he would then have to take a year to go to community college to then become eligible for that money, even though he feels he's ready. Apparently his grades show that he's ready, and he has been accepted. He's ready to go.
Have you ever had anybody apply? Do you know anybody who's applied for admission to a college and gotten turned down?
Do I know of anybody who has? Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
And do you have the college on your show to tell them why aren't you admitting when the college has its own eligibility criteria? We are a small private nonprofit that was established with private sources, and we have for 8 years said, here's the eligibility criteria. It's not like we're springing this on anybody. Now,
I'm not making a judgment per se. I'm just saying that I'm looking at this and saying that on the surface, a reasonable person might look at this and say it does not make sense.
Well, you know what? I will concede that. That on the surface, a reasonable person might look at this and look at this one case and this one snapshot as opposed to kind of a longer narrative and say it does not make sense.
But is it one snapshot or is it indicative of others who it would seem to me that as an underclassman, which is apparently when this young man was struggling, that if you weigh that equally with everything else, Should there be, I guess the question here is, should there be more flexibility? Should we look at formula?
There is flexibility already. And this young man, again, I'm very uncomfortable talking about this young man. He's a very special guy that I know, and he's part of a mentoring program that we started. And one reason he's done so well is because of this mentoring program that we started. And we have 100
sure.
or so African-American men who are investing in young men. And I am just delighted by that. And he is part of our appeals process. And this conversation is taking place offline, and I won't have it with you on the air.
That's fine.
It's just not fair to him. He was used in this story in ways that I think are entirely inappropriate for a minor to be used in the story for an agenda that is beyond his ability to manage.
Okay, in a broader sense, looking at the broader issue, okay, if we'll use it as a hypothetical. If there are cases mm-hmm. like this,
yeah.
Should the Pittsburgh Promise look at the formula that is currently used and perhaps consider reevaluating it or injecting some more flexibility? I'm saying and I'm saying that with your this other opportunity, this extension opportunity that's given to students in mind. Is there any way that someone down the road might look at this and say, we might be able to adjust this and do it differently?
Yeah, we never turn down somebody who wants to have a conversation about their individual case and have and be a part of the appeal process. We have received several hundred appeals since we started. We've not been able to say yes to all of them, but we have said yes to many of them, and we will continue to do that. We exist to create opportunities for kids, but we also know this, Paul. We also know this beyond any doubt, that that 100% of the college presidents that we have interviewed, and it's several dozen, 100% of them, when asked what is the best indicator for college readiness, all of them, without fail, say GPA. None of them have said an essay. None of them have said a test score. None have said that. They all said GPA is what tells us whether a kid is really ready for higher education or not. And what we are trying to do here is to ensure that we're not just simply throwing kids into the deep end and say, well, good luck, figure out how to swim, kid. What we want to do is the whole pipeline from the pre-K-12 and even before pre-K, what's happening at home and in the community, those are all factors that contribute to the kid's ability to perform and achieve. And I was on your show, if you remember. I've been on your show several times,
yes,
and I'm delighted by that. But one time in particular, exactly 2 years ago, I was here to talk about another criticism coming from the fringe right. And in that case, they were saying, forget about urban public schools, blow them up, they will never get it right. What you ought to do is take your money and give it to families so that they can send their kids to private K through 12 schools. So we have the fringe right who kind of argued about, we have no expectations for our schools, and now we have fringe left arguing we have no expectations of our kids. And we are basically saying, no, we have high expectations of our kids, of our schools, and we are absolutely convinced that our kids can perform and can deliver. And we have to get the schooling right. And we have seen, did you know that the high school graduation rates in Pittsburgh public schools that grew from 62% to 71% in the 6 years grew because African-American high school graduation rates grew? The white graduation rate has remained flat right around 80%. But the black high school graduation rate under this school reform work and being prompted by the promise has grown from mid-50s to upper 60s because of this work. And I celebrate that. So the work is gaining traction. It's not fast enough. We are not sewing up the holes in the safety net fast enough. But good work is occurring, not by lowering expectations, but by raising achievement. I refuse to listen to the fringe right who say, drop your expectations for public schools. And I refuse to listen to the fringe left who say, drop your expectations for our kids.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with Salim Gabriel. Let's go to Dave in Pittsburgh. Dave, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My biggest concern here is, you know, I mean, I think it's great that you're offering scholarships, but I mean, I'm seeing that there's some issues, you know, with receiving them. But we don't have one single technical school in the entire city. There is not one single technical school or technical programs that our kids can get into, you know, for vocational training, you know, whether it be, you know, welding, electrician work, auto mechanics, whatnot. We don't have a single program within the city schools. And you talk about that they can go on to a vocational school, but we don't even have a vocational school in high school for the kids to even get their hands dirty and see if they want to do and get into these high-paying trades. Have you done anything, or do you plan on doing anything to help get a vocational setting back into place in the Pittsburgh City School?
Dave, actually, there are vocational programs in 8 of our 10 high schools. So we have vocation. In fact, the Pittsburgh Promise currently funds high school kids to take college courses in health careers, in information technology, in HVAC, and then soon we'll be offering college courses that we're paying for while they are still in high school in advanced manufacturing, in the energy sector, in machining. So welding would be a part of that. Those programs exist currently in 8 of our schools, and they exist in high schools, and they are getting, in addition to the classes, they're getting OSHA certification, they're getting EPA certification. And with the combined Pittsburgh Promise college courses in technical areas, those kids will graduate from high school, of course, with a high school diploma, but also with somewhere between 12 and 24 college technical credits and 2 to 4 workforce certifications, plus a driver's license, because many of these jobs require moving around. So those currently exist, and what we're doing right now is actually accelerating that initiative. What doesn't exist, like the old days, is one building that housed all vocational education. Now they are dispersed in every community, north, south, east, and west in the city.
Dave, thank you for the phone call. Salim, is there anything that you're looking at as you, I'm assuming you do on a regular basis, which is to assess the overall effectiveness of the program, of the Pittsburgh Promise? Is there anything that you have looked at or are looking at and saying we can do this better or that better? Or do you feel like it's right where it needs to be?
No, we absolutely can do a whole bunch of things better. In fact, I had a very rich board meeting this week in which we were talking very specifically about this. We are pretty confident that the eligibility criteria for the scholarship itself should not be tinkered with. So the eligibility criteria is not going to change. It will continue to be 2.0 GPA for the extension, 2.5 for the core promise, and extension kids can become core promise kids after 1 year. So that eligibility criteria is not going to change. What we are fairly sure of is that there needs to be more support services that in the community alongside our schools to meet kids' mental health needs, to meet their physical health needs, to address some childhood trauma issues that are not being dealt with, to provide some academic support services, maybe even some financial literacy. So a number of community leaders are meeting on a fairly regular basis to figure out how it is that we, the community, can come alongside our schools so that our kids can have those things that lots of kids have because their families are able to provide them or their communities are able to provide them, but some kids are just not getting them. So absolutely, what we can do better is ensuring that the pipeline doesn't have as many holes in it and the support services that kids need are indeed in place.
So what you're saying is there needs to be more than just the opportunity available. There needs to be more support for the kids to reach those requirements.
Yeah, I mean, the scholarship by itself is not going to fix the problem. So there are some kids for whom the scholarship is absolutely a life changer. For other kids, our scholarship is a life enhancer. But I am very concerned about the same population of kids that you're talking about for whom the scholarship is not even relevant because they are not adequately prepared to take full advantage of it. So what we have been asked to do is eliminate the eligibility criteria. What we are instead doing is figuring out how we can get kids ready so that they can be eligible. And then how can we get more kids who are eligible but not using it to actually use it?
Salim Gubril is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Promise joining us in studio. Salim, as always, great thanks to you.
Thanks, Paul. Wonderful to be with you.
Coming up, we'll introduce you to two men traveling across America, one by bicycle, the other on foot, to help others. When Essential Pittsburgh continues on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. On many people's bucket lists is traveling cross-country. For some, it's the ultimate road trip, a chance to see America and create personal memories lasting a lifetime. We're going to introduce you to two men who are crossing the country this summer, one via bicycle, the other walking as a means of helping others. Up first is Greg Crawford, who is, during the academic year, Dean of the College of Science and Professor of Physics at the University of Notre Dame. Greg Crawford, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
As the Dean of the College of Science, rare disease research at Notre Dame has a long history. Talk about some of the data that you look into.
Sure. So it all started with our famous football coach, Errol Parseghian. He's a two-time national championship coach in the 60s and 70s. And he had a wonderful life, a son who went to Notre Dame, married his wife at Notre Dame. They had four beautiful children. And it turned out that three of these four kids had this very awful rare disease called Niemann-Pick type C. And so the whole Notre Dame family kind of rallied around Coach and the Parseghian family to help search for a cure in many ways and to fund research and go on this area, for example. And so in 2010, we formally combined forces, the university and the Errol Parseghian Medical Research Foundation, to actually move forward and support research on this very rare disease across the country, not just at Notre Dame, but at many other universities as well.
So how did you come up with the idea of raising awareness for this by doing these extraordinarily long cross-country bike rides?
Well, I came into Notre Dame in 2008. I was recruited to the university, and I'm a physicist by training. Yet I oversee all the sciences, and I oversee the Center for Rare and Neglected Diseases. And I didn't have the skill set to be involved with rare diseases. I'm not a chemist or a biologist or a medicinal chemist. But I was just moved by the story, and just I wanted to work with Coach and Cindy and Mike Parseghian to try to find a cure and fight for a cure. And so what I thought I could do is, since I couldn't do the research myself and be a part of it that way, that I could ride my bike around the country. It's a passion of mine, and raise money and awareness that way so I could fund other researchers.
In order to do this, I'm guessing that you have to go through some kind of a rigorous pre-ride workout just to get yourself physically ready to do this. What all does it entail?
Well, it's a good question. I think, you know, in Indiana, maybe much like Pittsburgh, we don't have great winters to be biking out and training. So
no, sir.
So we do a lot of indoor CrossFit training. And then in April, when it finally snow melts, then we can get out on the road. And so you only have about 4 weeks to get ready. But the first week of your ride, you end up getting in shape, and your neck, back, and bum all have to get into shape as well. And so those kind of sorenesses go away after the first week.
And there are other ways of bringing attention, certainly, to a cause as worthy as this one. You know, you could do a golf tournament. You could bring in celebrities, something that is certainly less demanding than this. Why this? I mean, you mentioned how this helps bring attention to it, but in terms of the difficulty, the degree of difficulty here, why didn't you settle on something easier than this?
Well, it's a good question, and I think when you look at these rare diseases, they're so difficult to fund. A big pharma company can't do the research needed on, you know, some 8,000 rare diseases, and the government can't fund some 8,000 rare disease research projects. And so we do whatever it takes, and it's just interesting from the standpoint of we do golf tournaments, we do celebrity functions, we do runs, the students organize runs, and there's a juggler at Notre Dame that raises money through juggling, and then the bicycling team at Notre Dame puts all their proceeds towards this rare disease, and so everyone's really rallied around it. And I've just been inspired personally by these families and these kids that you meet. It's a fatal childhood disease. They don't make it beyond their teen years, their early teen years, and the families are so strong. They persevere through a lot of challenges, and they have a lot of courage, and so I think it makes a lot of sense to use the bike as a vehicle to get around the country and to not just raise money at the alumni clubs that we visit. Pittsburgh's a great example of a lot of Notre Dame alumni in the area. But we also hit the media markets in different areas so people are aware of it all across the country, because it is, again, one of 8,000 rare diseases. And so there's a lot of attention that has to be, you know, shed on all these different diseases. And it's just one of that many.
And this is a disease that, you know, anything that devastates families as this has with former Coach Parseghian is certainly something to be taken seriously. But I've heard it said that you have been asked about working so hard to fight a disease that doesn't affect, relatively speaking, that many folks. And you have a very interesting answer to that.
Well, we always look at Notre Dame. It's, you know, it's our mission to kind of fight for the underserved, the people, poor people, et cetera, people that are homeless. And this is just one of those things that's it's the underdog in a sense. And whether or not it's one person or not, it's still important to our mission. That's one life that we think we could save.
And you've certainly gotten the point across about how Neiman Pick devastates the children of the families who are affected by this. But what exactly is this disease? How does it attack the body?
It's a disease which children cannot process cholesterol properly, so they can't metabolize it. And in a normal cell, cholesterol comes in and out, and it functions in that way. And in these children, the cholesterol just keeps building up, and it really gunks up their cells, and it leads to all kinds of failures and different organs, but ultimately it's neurodegenerative, so it gets in your brain, and then they can't function properly. So the end of life is a wheelchair, a feeding tube, a breather, and they're completely taken care of by professional medical staff until they pass away.
It's the Central Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Greg Crawford, who is Dean of the College of Science and Professor of Physics at the University of Notre Dame. He's biking across the country to raise awareness and funding for the fight against Niemann-Pick type C disease. Could you explain why you've decided to expand raising awareness this summer to other rare diseases?
Yeah, so we, in fact, our Center for Rare and Neglected Diseases expanded its own search for diseases that we could work on that were either related or we could sort of leverage our experience and expertise of our faculty members to look at other rare diseases. And there's a couple of other Notre Dame families that we've met. One is the Sarb family in Davenport, Iowa. And Mr. Sarb, the grandfather of this poor young man who has this disease, played for Coach Errol Parseghian. So he found out about this, and it's called NKH, another rare disease. And there's the Wilsley family out in California that belongs to the Notre Dame family as well, and they have an Englite problem with their child, and so they wanted to join on board. And so we are looking for, you know, people that have children or have rare diseases that, you know, nobody else is fighting for, and we just want to be a part of their lives to see if we can make a difference through our science.
You stop in cities along the way. You've made this stop in Pittsburgh. You are also scheduled to make a stop in Denver. What is the reason for that?
What we do is we actually go around and we engage our alumni clubs, and so we do a little event. And in that event, we tell them what we're doing while we're out here, and we give a little speech about what it is that Niemann-Pick is all about. And we bring in Coach or Cindy or Mike Parseghian when they're available and talk to the alumni. And then we raise money that way, and we bring awareness to the cause in that way. And so there's a lot of great Notre Dame cities around the country, like Pittsburgh. We have a lot of great alumni that live here, and so it was one of our stops this year.
And what is your goal for the cross-country ride this year? It's not the first time you've done something like this, that you've taken on this kind of challenge. So do you set goals in terms of fundraising, response? What would your goal be?
We do. This year, we set a goal of $1 million, and we're in day six or seven of the ride right now, and we're already at $800,000. And so by the time I get to Pebble Beach, California, in a few weeks, I hope to be over that goal.
Well, we certainly wish you luck, and thank you for making a stop here with us in our studios to discuss this incredible undertaking and all for a very good cause. We've been talking with Greg Crawford, who is Dean of the College of Science and Professor of Physics at the University of Notre Dame. He is biking across the country to raise awareness of the fight against Neiman K, and he is going to be continuing getting on his bike and heading out the door here momentarily. But in the meantime, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In an attempt to save lives, Pittsburgh native Jared Richbaum is walking across the country. The trek, which began in Atlantic City, will end in San Francisco. Taking a moment to update us on his progress, Jared Richbaum joins us from the road. Jared, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Good to be here.
How is your journey going?
The journey's going great. Really enjoying every moment so far, being outdoors and meeting people in small towns across the country. Really having a great time.
Where are you right now? Tell us how far you've made it.
I've made it almost 700 miles to the border of Indiana. I should be crossing over today. I'm in a town called Van Wert, Ohio, and I should be reaching Monroeville, Ohio, not to be confused with the Monroeville in Pittsburgh.
So tell our listeners why you're making this trek across the country.
So I have a friend who had a very rare blood disease called Shulman syndrome, which led to aplastic anemia, and she needed a bone marrow transplant to survive. And she found her match in her brother, who saved her life. And I flew out to California to follow her recovery and came to learn that there are about 14,000 patients in the U.S. that are diagnosed with life-threatening diseases every year, such as leukemia and lymphoma. And their best option for a cure is a transplant from an unrelated marrow donor. And they depend on the Be the Match registry to find a match. And I've chosen to walk for Be the Match. And there's less than 3% of eligible Americans that are currently registered. And there's thousands that will not find their match and unfortunately will pass away because of that. So I'm on a mission to personally swab cheeks and register people. So I carry around swab kits with me and set up events in different towns along the way and hopefully reach my goal of 600 people, adding 600 people to the registry.
We know there's always a need for blood donations. Is there a great need for bone marrow donors?
There is a huge need for bone marrow donors. It's something that a lot of people don't know about. Like I said, there's thousands of people in the U.S. that will not find their match. I've met a few people that have unfortunately gone years waiting on the waiting list without finding their match, and they don't have much longer. So it's a very simple process. You take a Q-tip swab to your cheek. They can match your skin cells with someone on the waiting list, and hopefully you can be someone's match and save a life. You know, just the best thing you can do is to save someone's life, and so easy.
Do you have any idea how many people you've signed up for the bone marrow registry?
I've registered about 100 people so far in about 6 weeks.
Traveling across the country is putting you in contact with a lot of people. What has been their reaction to your mission?
Most people are surprised at the number of people that can't find their match, and so therefore they're very willing to join the registry. But there are many that are also reluctant because they think that the process of becoming a donor is very painful. However, it's not very painful. You're put to sleep if you give your bone marrow. But 75% of the time, they just want your stem cells, which is like giving blood. And then 25% of the time, they would take shots out of your hip for a bone marrow. So both procedures can cause you to be sore for a day or two, but it's such a small price to pay to save somebody's life.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. I'm talking with Pittsburgh native Jared Richbaum, who's walking across the country, a cross-country trek taking him from Atlantic City to San Francisco as he raises awareness for bone marrow donations. And traveling, of course, is not cheap, even on foot. How are you minimizing the costs of your journey?
So I've been staying with guests along the way throughout Pennsylvania. I've known people from Penn State University, where I went, and friends of friends, and I've gotten donations. The people I've come across have just been so generous to me. A lot of people buy me meals when I stop in. I've done an online fundraiser, which helped me raise money also. So people have just been so generous towards me and my project.
And in addition to the media coverage you're receiving, how are you documenting your walk across America?
I'm actually filming a documentary about my whole adventure. I'm interviewing people everywhere I go and keeping a journal, and hope to submit my documentary into film festivals when this is all over.
And you've had a chance to do some pretty cool things. I think when you were in Pittsburgh, you got to throw out the first pitch at a Pirates game.
That's right. Yeah, that was, you know, probably the highlight of my trip so far. And I also was named the guest of the week at the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So, yes, it's been providing some really neat opportunities for me, but the walk is really about the people who are in need of a bone marrow transplant. So it's really a push for the awareness.
And, of course, along with these fun things you've had the privilege of doing, there are also the challenges. It's not all fun and games on this trip. Talk about some of the hardships. I mean, you're walking across the country. That has to be taking its toll on you mentally and probably physically as well.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I walk about 15 to 20 miles a day right now in the heat. And, you know, I stretch every day. I listen to my body. I have to treat blisters immediately. You know, I face the elements walking in pouring down rain. And when I started, it was very cold. So I've done a lot of research into the correct gear that I'll need. And I feel that I'm very prepared. And so far, I haven't had any hiccups along the way. And feeling good, the body's healthy, and just really listening to my body and what it's telling me.
And as you make your way west, is there terrain that is going to be particularly challenging, or some mountainous areas that are going to be foreboding in some way, shape, or form?
Yes, I'll be walking right through Colorado, so right over the Rockies. That's going to be probably the hardest physically for me. I do push a cart, which is a jogging stroller for dogs, and it weighs about 100 pounds. So hopefully I'll have some car support through the mountains, and I'll just walk with a backpack there. And hopefully I'll also have car support in the desert. So if I run out of water or get stranded, you know, I'll have a little backup. But yeah, the desert and the mountains are going to be two very tough terrains.
Besides walking across America, what else is on your bucket list?
I've done a lot of traveling, but I always want to travel. So I've never been to Australia, never been to most of the countries in Africa. So visiting countries is really on my bucket list. But then small things such as, you know, learning sign language and learning French. And, you know, I get to listen to some audiobooks along the way, so I can learn French as I walk, which is kind of cool. I am also practicing my Spanish, which I'm nearly fluent in, but that's just something that keeps me busy during the long days.
It'll all come in handy when you walk across Europe.
We'll see how this one goes.
At the end of the journey, what are you hoping to take away from this trip?
I really hope to make an impact that's everlasting. I want to really raise the awareness that's needed. You know, so many people are okay with giving blood and don't know about giving bone marrow or becoming a donor. I just really want people to know that it's a painless process and it's a way to save somebody's life. That's the most important. Personally, you know, I'm sure I'll feel a sense of accomplishment and, you know, I'm going to make a great film. And the people that I meet along the way, I'm sure I'll make lifelong friends, which I've already made. And that's pretty important to me. It's just, you know, all we have is each other and the relationships that we make. So I hope to stay in touch with a lot of the people that I meet along the way.
We've been talking with Pittsburgh native Jared Richbaum. He's walking across the country to raise awareness for the Bone Marrow Registry, starting in Atlantic City, and he is going to end up in San Francisco. Jared, when do you think you'll be in the Bay Area?
Well, if all goes to plan and I stay healthy, I should reach San Francisco by mid to late October.
Well, good luck. We'll be rooting for you.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate you having me.
Our pleasure. More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. June is Gay Pride Month around the world, but here in Pittsburgh, on the eve of the Pride in the Street event, there's an ongoing conversation about diversity and inclusiveness among Pittsburgh's LGBT organizations and larger community. Recent controversy over the choice to feature pop singer Iggy Azalea at Pittsburgh Pride is part of a larger conversation about diversity and inclusiveness. Critics charge that the Delta Foundation of Pittsburgh, which coordinates Pittsburgh Pride, does not represent the full diversity of gay life in the Pittsburgh area, and alternative organizations are emerging to fill the gaps. Joining us today to talk about one such organization, Roots Pride Pittsburgh, are Joy Kimmett and Michael David Battle. Again, they are the creators of Roots Pride Pittsburgh. Joy, Michael, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Criticism of the Delta Foundation certainly did not start with the planned Iggy Azalea concert, which has since been canceled, of course. But can you explain how that was maybe one side of bigger ongoing issues or one sign of bigger ongoing issues?
Yeah, I think that it was symbolic of or emblematic of bigger issues of Delta really being out of touch with the community and the needs of the community. Bringing a rapper who has who culturally appropriates her accent and the way that she performs, and also has sent homophobic and racist tweets, seems to me to be sort of representative of how Delta tends to operate.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with that completely. It's been years of that, and Pittsburgh Pride in particular, Delta Foundation, they've had several events that have been really controversial, but I think that Iggy Azalea was just like this representation of, we really don't care what the community wants, because Iggy has been somebody who's been controversial in hip hop in general, and it has been said over and over that there's been homophobia, transphobia, racism, and there's been, I mean, literally nationwide conversations about it. And so for Delta not to know that means that they're not entrenched in the community enough.
So when their defenders, when Delta's defenders say that any exclusion on the part of the foundation has been unintentional, is that a satisfying answer to you?
Absolutely not.
Now, the Delta Foundation does not actually say, quote, we speak for the entire spectrum of Pittsburgh's LGBT community, end quote. But do you feel that it makes that claim in an implicit way?
When you go to Delta's website and you look at their mission statement, they claim to be the leading LGBT organization in Western Pennsylvania. So I think that it does. They do sort of claim that they are representing all of us.
So how is Roots Pride Pittsburgh different? And what is the goal of your organization?
I think that Roots Pride Pittsburgh is different because, first and foremost, we are listening to the community. We make every effort to be as inclusive and accessible as possible. And also, we are the community. We are not separate from the community. We're having conversations. We're communicating with everybody. We are having open forums and political dialogue about what does it mean to actually be LGBT in the Pittsburgh area.
Yeah, I mean, I think also one of the things that I found really cool is that we've used the full acronym of LGBTQIA positive throughout the campaign. And to hear other organizations saying that, like, for the first time, and really, and even if they stumble a little bit, they still are using the full acronym. And that in and of itself is inclusion. And that has changing the, that has changed the conversation here in Pittsburgh, as opposed to just saying LGBT, where you're leaving out all these other folks who are not being represented. I think that that has been, that's been really cool for me to witness, as we, because we're 3 weeks in.
Yeah.
Are there other ways in which you feel that people are, that the interests of everyone, in terms of being all inclusive, that that there is a void, that, that there is a lack of inclusiveness? Are there other things that you have identified and that you feel?
I mean, I think one of the things that I've seen is that folks who have disabilities have not been included. And so the spaces at when you go to Pittsburgh Pride are not accessible, and there's no interpreter. So when we had our town hall meeting last night and even throughout the weekend, that's something that we've really been intentional about. But also, I think Joy said it perfectly. We've had folks who have reached out to us and said, you know, I'm a part of the asexual community. How can we be included? Or I'm a part of the deaf or hard of hearing community. How can I be included? And so really being intentional and thinking about those things, like, I have children, mm-hmm. so making sure there's childcare, and making sure that there's an adequate amount of folks who are doing childcare. So,
and also not assuming that we know everything that the community needs, but really being open to that feedback, really being open to hearing what, you know, what is necessary for everybody to be able to attend and participate. Yesterday we had our town hall meeting, and there was a person there that was autistic, and they were saying that they really needed to have a quiet room and a quiet space. And so those are the type of things that we take into consideration as we move forward in planning our programming.
And why do you think that these concerns have not, I mean, when you mention them, some of them seem to be obvious. Why do you suppose they have not been taken into consideration in the past?
I think that people do not think that they need to look beyond themselves. And I think that that's just the bottom line. So when people say things like, oh, it's unintentional that Iggy was brought, or, oh, yeah, it may very well be that a lot of these oversights are unintentional. But when you claim to represent an entire community, you have to look beyond just yourself, your demographic, and your friends. You have to look at the entire community and respond to those, to those needs.
There seems to be a perception out there as a result of some of the recent occurrences, recent happenings, that the local gay community is divided or in conflict with itself. But if people do, in fact, have those perceptions, what would you say to those concerns?
I think for me, I think we have to acknowledge that we are divided. In this country, you're talking about a country that's founded on genocide and forced labor, right? And so that in and of itself means that you have a foundation of division. There are people who are constantly seeking to get rights and access to resources and tools. So there, and especially here in this city, if you're a person of color, your access to healthcare, your access to education, your access to employment, your access to housing is so far below where white folks are, where heteronormative folks are, where cisgender folks are, that we have to acknowledge that there's division, right? And so just because you identify as LGBTQIA or positive doesn't mean that you have escaped the indoctrination of racism. It doesn't mean that you don't benefit from systemic power or privilege, right? You don't benefit from white privilege. And so we have to think about that, and think about the privilege that that has even within the LGBTQIA positive community.
I always like to quote Audre Lorde on this and say, it's not our differences that divide us. It's our inability to recognize, accept, and celebrate those differences. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the times when people are planning things, they are thinking about just themselves. So, you know, unity doesn't just come with just saying it. You have to do it.
That's a great note to end on. Joy Kimmett, Michael David Battle, creators of Roots Pride Pittsburgh, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. We are out of time. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everyone.